That's Eddie Harris with Freedom Jazz Dance. It's from his 1965 album, The In Sound. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. We conclude today the discussion on the Dred Scott decision of 1857, a case often cited as producing the worst ruling in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Legal scholar Paul Finkelman, you may recall, had given us in two consecutive weeks a detailed background case and the constitutional questions it raised. Professor Finkelman teaches constitutional law, legal history, and race and the law at Albany Law School in New York. Dred Scott, enslaved at birth, estimated at around 1799 in Southampton County, Virginia, sued for his freedom and the freedom of his wife and two daughters on the grounds that they had lived in Illinois and the Wisconsin Territory, where slavery had been outlawed. But the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 7-2 ruling, said that no person of African ancestry ever was meant to be a citizen of the United States, nor to benefit from any rights guaranteed by the Constitution. Today we hear from Justice Stephen Breyer, an associate justice on the U.S. Supreme Court, on the matter. This was a talk he gave at the New York Society for Ethical Culture 5 years ago.
The problem, when the issues involved are not at this intersection of law and politics, you get a good legal issue that's also a hot political issue, and that problem is there with a vengeance. Now, there are many examples of that, and I'm not going to report to you all of them. I'm just talking about one, because it's been hard to do. In fact, Dred Scott was only the second time in the history of the country where the Supreme Court did try to strike down a statute as unconstitutional, Marbury versus Madison being the first. But I picked this one out because it's an example of where I think the court went really wrong, and everyone else in the country thinks the court went really wrong, and we can learn something from that. Now, what are we going to learn? Well, we'll learn something, I hope, after about 45 minutes or 50 minutes of explanation of what actually went on in that case. So now let's go back to these early 1850s and see what was going on in the Dred Scott case. Let's start with the list of characters, and I think there are three major characters I'd like you to know something about. One is Dred Scott. Dred Scott was born in the early part of the 19th century, and he was born in Virginia, and he was born a slave. His owner was Peter Blow, and the Blow family was pretty nice to him, but they fell on hard times. They moved to St. Louis, and Peter Blow sold him to Dr. John Emerson, who was an army doctor, who took Dred Scott around as his slave to various army bases. One of those bases was Fort Armstrong in Illinois. And Illinois was a free state. Then he took Dred Scott up to Fort Snelling, Minnesota, which happened to be in the territory of Wisconsin. Now that's a little confusing, because I don't know whether it was Wisconsin in the territory of Minnesota or Minnesota in the territory of Wisconsin. But whichever it was free. It was not a state, but it was free. And there was a congressional statute in the Missouri Compromise that said this is a free place. And Dred Scott lived there for 3 years, and he got married there to his wife, Harriet. And eventually, Harriet and he, after 3 years, came back on the boat down the Mississippi River to St. Louis. Now, at that point, Dr. Emerson died. His wife inherited Dred Scott. Harriet, the historians tell us, got a little bit dissatisfied with this situation. And she and Dred Scott sued. They brought lawsuit in order to become free. That lawsuit first started out in the state courts, and it was against Emerson, and then it went over to the federal court where it became the famous case. And by that time, Mrs. Emerson's brother, Sanford, a citizen of New York, was the owner of Dred Scott, and that's why the name of the case, Dred Scott v. Sanford. All right, now you see who Dred Scott was. And he had a few, what I'd call, courage. And so did his wife. Now, they brought these cases. Now, the second person to keep in mind is Roger Taney. There's a portrait of him in the Supreme Court, which isn't all that good. And when I show visitors around, I say usually, there's a portrait of Roger Taney painted by Dred Scott. Now, that isn't actually true. Fact is that he was born in Maryland, 1777. He was had a tobacco plantation, and he was a slave owner. But he freed his slaves. And if you look at what he wrote, sometimes he wrote about what an evil slavery was. And then other times he would say, no, they have no legal rights at all, free or not free. He was connected very politically with Andrew Jackson. And Andrew Jackson appointed him eventually, and he became a member of the Supreme Court. And he was a very intelligent man, apparently, and had a pretty good legal mind. Willard Wirtz, who was a great attorney general of that time, called him, said that he had a moonlight mind, that it clarified without the heat. All right, the third person to keep in mind, Benjamin Curtis. Benjamin Curtis was a citizen of Massachusetts, a lawyer there, and he was appointed by Millard Fillmore to the Supreme Court because he was a moderate on the slavery issue. He served for 6 years. He quit after the Dred Scott decision. He said he had done so because he doubted his usefulness on the court in its present condition. And he may have had financial reasons as well. The historians are uncertain. So those are our three main characters. Now also, I'd like you to keep in the back of your mind as background what this was, this great political issue of the day, this issue of slavery. And it was many, many things. But for present purposes, I think there are two that you want to focus on. And one is when this Constitution was written, there were all kinds of compromises put in it to try to get those southern states to come along. And Ben Franklin, to the contrary, notwithstanding, lots of those founders put in compromises that would preserve slavery at least for a while. It said no law is going to be made to stop the importation before 1808. And it said you're not going to change this law. You can't just change it and then move that up. But the most important, which I think not everyone knows about, was a provision that said when you take the census, you will count every slave as 3/5 of a person. Now, what was the point of that? If I ask the class immediately, they think, oh, that's bad, it should have been a whole person. I'll tell you, it would have been worse if it had been a whole person, much worse. The point of it was to take a state like Virginia or Georgia and say, when we look at your population, we're going to give you a lot of extra population because you have slaves. And so since you have that extra population, you will get more representatives in Congress. But you don't let the slaves vote. So it'll be the white people there who will vote on the basis of a representation that counts slaves to make it bigger. Well, that's the one the South really liked. See, because that, they figured, is going to give us a lock on the Congress. And that's what they wanted. They wanted that guarantee. Now, that lock lasted for quite a while. But they made a miscalculation. They thought that the population in the United States would develop towards the Southwest. They were just about 100 years out of date on that. I mean, fly over Phoenix, you'll see they were right, but it's too late for them. Instead of it developing towards the Southwest, where they thought that they would become slave states, it developed northwest. And as the population grew, and as it developed northwest, they began to lose their lock, even with that advantage of 3/5 of a person for each slave being counted. And they became very worried in the South. Because they saw, as more and more states came in that were free states, they're going to pass a law, and that law is going to outlaw slavery, and they didn't like that. Hence, a series of compromises. I'm oversimplifying for the historians here know that, but maybe others don't, but I'm oversimplifying, but there was the Missouri Compromise that came after the Northwest Ordinance. And the Missouri Compromise, like the Northwest Ordinance, say there will not be slavery up there. And up there was usually towards the north and towards the west, north and west of Missouri. No slaves. And then that wasn't working too well because the South got very unhappy about that. And so they said, all right, Texas, which is in the South, can come in as a slave state, but California will come in as a free state. And then when they got around to Nebraska and when they got around to Missouri, they just said, let them do what they want, and then everybody started to fight. They were having trouble with that. And the point I want you to see is, one, the constitutional provisions, which I've described, but two, as I read about it, I would say there was a degree of tremendous hostility that was not only that intersectional hostility because one wanted to be a slave and the other not, but total suspicion each of the other. The South, you see, thought what was going to happen is that the North would get the votes and they'd vote out slavery. And the North thought what was going to happen is that the South would take the institutions that it controlled, the presidency and the Supreme Court. And another story, which I can't go into, which is interesting, is the Electoral College had a lot to do with the way in which the South had extra influence in selecting the presidency and in selecting the Supreme Court. But they thought the South had some control over those institutions, and what they were afraid of is that what the South will do is they're going to figure out some way to spread that slavery all over the place. Now, those were two concerns. And the South was emotionally concerned, and so was the North. And it's in that context that suddenly Dred Scott comes along. All right, now let's go back to the case. In a way, sadly for you, I'm very interested in the case. I mean, I'm a judge. And so what I've contributed to this is I've read the case. I went back and read it, and it's long. And when I read it, I don't totally see it as an historian. I see it as a judge. I think those are people who had jobs like mine, and I want to read it, and I want to know what they thought, and I want to know why they wrote those words. So that, for better or worse, is the perspective that you're going to get. Well, what were the legal issues, and how did they come up? Well, first thing that happened, as I told you, is that Dred Scott and his wife brought a suit in the state court of Missouri. And they said, we're free. Now, why were they free? They were free because it was pretty well established under the common law of Missouri and under the common law, as Curtis later shows, of countries throughout the world, that if you bring your slave into a place that is a free place, and you're not just visiting briefly, but you're there for an extended period of time, and maybe you intend to stay there, that slave is free. And what Dred Scott and their lawyers thought is, well, that's the law of that's the common law of Missouri. So we'll bring a suit right there and we will be free because we had 3 years up there in Fort Snelling and we had some more time in Illinois too. And so that's long enough. We're free. Well, they may have thought they're free, but the Missouri court held the opposite. And they said in response to the lawyers for Dred Scott, look at the common law of this state, too. They said, quote, well, the times are not now what they were then. That's a point. I've never thought of using that one, but maybe. But in any case, they lost. And so now they proceed to the great case. Because now they want to bring the same suit in the federal court, but this time against Sanford, who by this time is the owner of Dred Scott and Harriet. And there, in the lower courts, they lost because the lower court said, well, we'll follow Missouri. By the way, for the lawyers among you, it wasn't so clear that federal courts at that time had to follow Missouri on federal law. Because it used to be that people thought that laws up there in the sky, at least the common law, and federal judges will figure it out just as well as the state judges. Now, we've changed that, but that's another lecture, which I can't even give because it's really for the teachers of procedure, which is so complicated, it is well beyond me. But nonetheless, it wasn't as clear right then as it is now that they had to follow the state law, even on state matters. So they brought the case in federal court. Maybe it wasn't as clear, but the federal court said, no, no, we're following them. Lost again. And now, suddenly, the Supreme Court decides to hear the case. And people across the nation have been paying attention. And they see that this is a major case on the status of a person who is a slave and wants to be free, or the status of a person who is free but was a slave. There are two big questions in this case. The first question is a question that's really good for procedure teachers, but my goodness, it swallowed up the whole case. Can this court hear the case? Well, why not? I'll come to why not. I don't think I'll tell you yet. I will keep you in suspense for another minute. Does it have the power to hear this case? Well, if it does, we get to the next question. Is he free or is he not free? Those are the two questions. In 1856, those two questions are argued in the Supreme Court for 4 days. And as I said, it was a well-known case. Judge Curtis heard the argument made on behalf of Dred Scott by his brother. I mean, the ethical rules were not quite as tight then, I guess, at the point. I mean, I have a brother who's a judge, but I don't sit on those cases. But I think, well, anyway. There were members of Abraham Lincoln's cabinet to be senators who argued on one side or the other. It was followed. And then the Supreme Court suddenly asked for more briefing and more cases on what I've called the jurisdictional issue. Do we have the power to hear this case? And apparently, what happened was that they were trying to reach an agreement. They were trying to reach a unanimous conclusion, have a short opinion that nobody paid too much attention to, and they couldn't get agreement. They couldn't get everyone to agree. And when they couldn't get everyone to agree, Roger Taney, the Chief Justice, said, well, okay, you won't agree, fine. I have the majority, I will write the opinion, you write the dissent you want. He wouldn't have said it in that tone of voice exactly. He would have said it politely, but that's what it would have meant. I've heard that before. Now, on March 6th, 1857, the opinion is ready, and Taney reads it from the bench. Curtis then reads, for more than a day, his dissent. And Taney then, interestingly enough, decides he better rewrite the opinion. And he rewrote it, and it appeared in May. All right, now, brought you up to speed. We are now ready to look at what these issues were in that case. What was this decision? Well, the first, remember I told you the jurisdictional question? I'll tell you what that is. See, we in the federal courts can't just hear any old case. The cases that we have to hear have to be cases that here in Article 3 it tells us that we can hear. And those are a limited number of cases. And the clause that was relevant to this particular case was a clause that says that the judicial power of the United States extends to controversies between citizens of different states. There we are. Got it? Between citizens of different states. Now, Sanford is a citizen of New York. But what about Dred Scott? Well, here you have to do a little normal, tricky thing legally. You have to say, well, suppose he wins. If he wins, will he be a citizen of Missouri? And that's a fair question. And what the court says there is, well, whether he's a citizen of New Jersey or not, they're talking here really about people who are citizens of the United States, as well as a state. And no, Dred Scott is not a citizen of the United States, win, lose, or draw. He is not a citizen of the United States because he is a Negro whose ancestors were imported into this country and sold as slaves. Now, that doesn't sound very good, but what he actually said is really worse. What he said was, public opinion at the time the Constitution was written considered Africans so far inferior to the white race that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. I'll tell you about that. That's the phrase that made the case famous or infamous, right there. And he says, they couldn't. I'll have more to say about that phrase. Well, what's your reason, Chief Justice Taney? How did you reach that conclusion? Well, he says, I looked at a lot of things. I looked at a lot of things. First, I looked at the states that had freed African slaves, like Massachusetts, New Hampshire, New York. And I'll tell you something about them. Even they would not treat these people equally in respect to education or in respect to letting them join the militia. All right, that's one reason. And he says, secondly, the founders had slaves too, didn't they? And you think they were treating them as equals? No. And the third reason, he says that, well, if you look at these statutes written at the time, if you look at the statutes written at the time, you'll see that some of them talk about citizens and persons of color. Well, if they make that distinction, that must mean the persons of color aren't citizens. And then some attorney generals have said the same thing, namely himself. And then he said, look at this other part of the Constitution here. This other part says, the citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens in the several states. That means if you're a citizen of Massachusetts and that you go down to Alabama, they have to treat you as such. Do you think they would have treated a black person as such at that time down in Alabama, if he came from sea? He says, they never thought that. They never thought these people were citizens. And hear what he says on that. Let me just see. 16, good sentence. The court, he says, having listed these reasons, must not give to the words of the Constitution a more liberal construction in their favor than they were intended to bear when the instrument was framed and adopted. It must be construed now as it was construed then. All right. Now, before you draw any conclusions at all, one good thing I've learned as a judge, and probably you, the lawyers among you, is let's listen to the other side. What is it that Curtis had to say in dissent on this point? Well, first, I'm paraphrasing. Chief Justice Taney, you said that there were five states that did free slaves, and they didn't let them have total education, and they didn't let them join the army. Okay, so what? They let them vote. And moreover, I have an opinion here from the Supreme Court of North Carolina, which is one of them, and that Supreme Court opinion says that the freed slave is a citizen of North Carolina. And I will tell you, in addition, that the people in those states who voted, who were in fact people of African descent, voted to adopt the Constitution. They voted for delegates to the state convention that went off and decided whether to adopt the Constitution. Is it likely that the framers would have thought that people who were voting whether to adopt or not to adopt that very document were not citizens of the United States? And if you want a little bit more, what about reading the Declaration of Independence? I mean, it does say all men are created equal. They did have a point. And those were some of the framers that you thought were slave owners. But they said it, and they meant it. And why do we have diversity jurisdiction? We have the citizens of states, different states in the federal courts, because We want to prevent prejudice against one of the parties, and we're afraid the state courts will be prejudiced. Well, if you want a group that you could be prejudiced against, there's your group. And if you want some old statutes that support you, I have 19 over here that support me. And he lists them all. I will spare you. And as far as that privileges and immunities clause is concerned, where you said, well, what about Alabama? Alabama would never have accepted somebody coming from Massachusetts and trying to exercise his rights there if that person coming were an African American. Well, I'll tell you something. That clause comes from the Articles of Confederation, and when they were considering adopting it, a couple of southern states moved an amendment which would have said it applies to, and it said all inhabitants. It would have said all white inhabitants, and that white was defeated by a vote of 7-2. Okay? Good, we feel a little better. I felt a lot better when I read that. And maybe I was being a little biased, but I thought perhaps calm. And, oh, by the way, he said that. You see, I sympathize a lot with that. Curtis uses the word a calm comparison of words like all men are created equal. And what the why does he say calm? Because he didn't like that phrase that Taney used. And he doesn't want to engage in kind. So he says, calm down. And let's look at what the framers actually thought. So he has some pretty good arguments, I think, in counterbalance to those of Taney. But now Taney goes further. Having said, with his majority, having said that the African descendant, he then says, now we'll go on to decide whether he was freed. At this point, Curtis says, what? You just said you didn't have the power to hear the case because he's not a citizen of the United States. How, if you don't have the power to hear the case, can you go on to decide whether he's free or not free? This seems to us lawyers like a pretty good point. However, it did not seem to Taney to be such a good point. Indeed, he didn't think it was one worth answering. So he now goes ahead and decides whether or not Dred Scott is free. And Curtis has said, well, of course he's free. He lived for 3 years up there in Fort Snelling. He married Harriet while he was there. They intended to stay there if they possibly could. This is a man under the law of England, under the law of Wisconsin, which was the territory of Wisconsin, under the law of Illinois, under whatever law you want in those free states, he's free. That's not the way I see it, says Chief Justice Taney. Well, how do you see it? Well, he says, the reason that the law in Wisconsin says that we have to apply this law there, Wisconsin, which says you're free, is because Congress passed that law. That's true. Congress did pass the law. And they passed it under the Territories Clause of the Constitution. That's a provision that says Congress has the power to pass a law to run the territories. That's true. And he says, but the territory's law is unconstitutional. I mean, what? I mean, what? No, says, you mean, it doesn't have the, why? It says you can have run territories, pass laws for territories. He says, territories, they just meant by territories, West Virginia. And those parts of the country that in 1789, when it was historically written, were called territories. And they never called Wisconsin a territory at that time because they didn't even know Wisconsin existed. They never ate any cheese or anything. But they didn't know about Wisconsin. All right, you see? So there we are. They had no power to do it. And anyway, even if they had the power to do it, because Curtis does have a pretty good answer to that one, he says, we've admitted 6 states under the Louisiana Purchase, and we've made laws for all of them under this territories clause. Now, you're really saying all those laws are invalid? No, it doesn't matter, because even if I'm wrong about that, says Taney, even if I'm wrong about that, the due process clause, no one shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, so Congress has no constitutional power to pass a law that enables a state to take from the slave owner his lawful slave, which is a form of property. Curtis, what? Do you know where that phrase comes from? It's a form of language used in the Magna Carta in 1215. Do you think that the Magna Carta meant that? You think, if you think it meant that, then the laws of England that became free were violating Magna Carta. The laws of England that say slaves are free over there are violating the Magna Carta. And I haven't heard a word of anyone screaming how that violates the Magna Carta. And so did the laws in half the states which copied the same language. I think they were violating the Magna Carta. But I haven't heard anyone say they were violating the Magna Carta. In fact, he says, slavery, where it was lawful, has always been treated as a very special kind of property. And where lawful, you have to have very serious positive restrictions about just what it is. That's Curtis. And anyway, how are you going to work your system, he asks. If in your system, Mr. Smith from Alabama brings his slave up to work in and live in Wisconsin, under your theory, if they're there for 30 years, it's slave law that governs that slave. Now, I'll tell you something. Wisconsin doesn't have any slave law. So what law governs that individual when he gets married, has children, has a little bit of property, does anything, dies, and leaves some a few sticks? What governs it? The law of what? You say he brings the law of Alabama with him? Well, if you do, suppose another one, similar condition, comes from Georgia. Does he bring Georgia law with him? Does somebody else bring Mississippi law with him? And pretty soon you're asking these judges up there in Wisconsin to apply in respect to the few slaves whom really should be free, but in fact you've said aren't free. One has to apply Georgia law, and another has to apply Alabama law, and another has to apply Mississippi law. This will never work. It is totally impractical, and that proves how wrong you must be. All right? Well, I hope you found these arguments excellent. I found Curtis's argument very good. But the court reached a different conclusion. The holding? Scott cannot bring his case in federal court because freed slaves are not citizens of the United States. Two, many congressional anti-slavery spreading statutes, including the Missouri Compromise, are unconstitutional. Three, the Fifth Amendment's Due Process Clause protects the ownership rights of slaveholders even when they take their slaves into free territories and into free states to live for extended periods of time. Now you see where I took the really famous derogatory phrase, and I just wanted you to hear it, but it's much worse than that. Because look what this case has held. Not only no jurisdiction, but also that major laws of Congress trying to deal with the slavery problem are unconstitutional, and the Due Process Clause is going to mean that this man who is the slaveholder cannot be deprived of his slaves even when he lives in a free territory. Now do you see why it struck people as pretty shocking at the time? But what was that aftermath when that came down? Spring of 1857, President Buchanan liked it. The Southern sympathizers liked it. But they didn't say all that much about it. But in the North, the reaction was pretty negative, vehemently so. New York, particularly. Horace Greeley. Wicked, atrocious. If epithets and denunciations could sink a judicial body, the Supreme Court would never be heard of again. The New York State Senate Judiciary Committee. The decision has destroyed the confidence of the people in the court. The committee predicted the decision would be overruled. It described Taney's statement that the colored race had no rights which white men were bound to respect as inhuman, unchristian, atrocious, disgraceful to the judge who uttered it and to the tribunal which sanctioned it. The report said the opinion paved the way for slavery's spread to free states. If, this is the report, a master may take his slave into a free state without dissolving the relation of master and slave, then some future decision of the pro-slavery majority of the Supreme Court will authorize a slave driver to call the roll of his manacled gang at the foot of the monument on Bunker Hill, reared and consecrated to freedom. Another example, Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist. He described it as a devilish decision produced by the slave-holding wing of the Supreme Court. He said the court cannot make evil good or evil good evil, but the decision, he concluded, is a means of keeping the nation awake on a subject. My hopes were never brighter than now. Indeed, the decision did keep the nation awake. The supporters of abolition, and many who weren't real abolitionists, they printed up Curtis's dissent and they distributed it all over the country. Abraham Lincoln, then a presidential Republican candidate for Senate, spoke often about the decision. He described it as a legal astonisher, while arguing that Taney's whites-only views had turned our once glorious Declaration of Independence into a wreck and mangled ruin. Lincoln based his famous Cooper's Union speech here, the speech that made him particularly famous as a national political figure, on Curtis's dissent. He argued for the founder's view of the Constitution, a view that he said, and he did, deny the despotism of slavery, unless he added that that view conflicted with some yet more basic principle that the founders had held, and there was none. He fed politically what was the North's fear of the spreading slavery by asking, see how he's repeating, he's going to repeat what the New York legislature said. He said, what is necessary for the nationalization of slavery? It is merely for the Supreme Court to decide that no state under the Constitution can exclude it, just as they have already decided that under the Constitution, neither Congress nor the territorial legislature can do it. Now, historians debate the precise role of Dred Scott in causing the Civil War, but we can see that at a minimum, it helped Lincoln, and it helped Lincoln articulate abolitionist views. And it gave him and helped give him political visibility, which led to his election, and the war followed. The North won. The 14th, 13th, 15th amendments were the result in the Constitution. No slavery, equal protection of the laws, no discrimination in voting. All right? There we are. That's the story. On a personal level to the individuals, what happened? Well, Roger Taney stayed on till 1864 when he died. And Dred Scott, though not released from slavery, was bought by the children of Peter Blow, his original owner, and they freed everybody. But he died very shortly thereafter of tuberculosis. Curtis, as I said, had resigned. Well, what are, to go step back for a minute, what are the lessons that I like to draw from this story, which is a very interesting historical story in and of itself? But I'd like to draw a few that may have some interest for current times, at least for a judge who works on a court, which is the descendant of the court that Taney served on. So when I read those opinions, which I've done, certain things stick out, and I'll list five of them for you. The first is to go back to my friend, that terrible rhetoric. Now, I've read quite a few, not a lot, but a significant number, of Supreme Court opinions, even from that time, and there's nothing like that. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that phrase, whether they were slaveholders or whether they weren't slaveholders. And I know perfectly well that when, as a judge, you're writing an opinion, be careful what you write. And indeed, people will take it to mean that's what you think, even if, as Taney did, he said, oh, it's not what I think, it's what somebody else thought 100 years ago. Don't kid yourself. You can't distance yourself from the language that you use. And indeed, that explains to me, which I find by far the more dignified, Curtis's use of the word calm. Let's tone this down. No need for that expression. A second lesson, which I find really positive, is that reason matters. I mean, of course, my professional life is committed to that, so I should certainly hope so. But look at the play and the respect that Curtis got for his decision. It's a pretty good decision, in my opinion. It's stronger from the point of review of reason. I mean, other things I think he's totally very hard to argue with are the fact we did have 5 states at the time of the founding that did treat freed slaves in every way as citizens, but they were discriminatory in education and they were discriminatory in terms of the militia. That doesn't mean they weren't citizens. It's pretty hard for Taney to draw that latter conclusion from those instances, particularly when you have North Carolina's opinion saying they are citizens. I think it's pretty strong when he says, if you've decided there's no jurisdiction, why are you deciding the case? I think it's pretty strong when he goes into the Due Process Clause and starts talking about the Magna Carta and a long history that never interpreted the Due Process Clause that way in the past. And it's that opinion that was circulated. It's not the most beautiful rhetoric in the world. It is not some of the great classical writing of all time. It will not be found in the Oxford History of great Anglo-American prose. But its reasoning is strong. Its reasoning is strong, and when it was circulated and people read it, it helped convince. And that's what a good judicial opinion ought to do. So I take lots of comfort in that. The third thing that I think I learn in terms of a lesson here is something really about the Constitution. Well, the third maybe about the court. Remember, I started out by saying that Hamilton had this idea that the court would, in fact, offer some kind of guarantee that the other branches of government would remain within the strictures of the Constitution. Now, when we are interpreting that document, the way I think of it myself, metaphorically, is I think of it as we're sort of like the boundary patrol. We try to see that the others stay within the boundary. That's what the Constitution does. It writes a list of boundaries. It creates democratic institutions, protects individual rights, assures a degree of equality, separates powers, state, federal, and 3 branches, and insists on a rule of law. And it has a lot of rules that do that, a certain number, not too many. And we're there to patrol those boundaries. Well, life on the frontier and the boundary is often tough, and interpreting it is often tough. That's why there are a lot of 5-4 decisions. It's not just that one group is benighted and the other isn't. If you're there for a while, you see that those who disagree with you, as much as you'd like to think they were benighted, they actually aren't. They actually just have a different point of view. Wrong though it may be, in my view. Oh, they think the same of mine. All right, so there we are. And that is what it's like. And so when you get into some of these issues that have a big political content, but this, I'd like people to think about this case. Because this case says, don't try the politics. Don't try it. There is a theory that what Taney was trying to do was to avoid the Civil War. His friends in Congress had been telling him that if you can get this thing decided once and for all by an institution with the prestige of the Supreme Court, people will accept it. It will bring peace to the nation. He believed that, perhaps, if he was being political. And to me, what it suggests is, don't be political for two good reasons. Three, one, it's wrong. Two, the whole point of this institution that Hamilton set up was to have a group of people who weren't politicians who would be deciding this. Because if you wanted politicians to decide it, give the job to Congress. But third, and perhaps just as important, is if judges are going to decide things on a political basis, remember they're terrible politicians. There isn't one I've ever seen that's any good at it. I mean, well, if you want to be, they're good politicians, but they're not judges. They have life in politics. And if Taney was being political, remember, he's about the worst politician you ever saw because he brought about the exact opposite of the objective that he was trying for. If he wanted a peaceful nation, if anything, he helped produce a war. Fourth, I think it tells us something about the nature of the Constitution. Because when you really lean over backwards, sideways, and say, is there anything we can think as to how he could have been thinking this? Well, maybe he had some vision of the Constitution, that it wasn't really a document that sort of creates a government for everybody. It was like a treaty. And in this treaty, the South was supposed to have a veto power over everything that would major, in a major way, affect them in respect to slavery. Well, there are a few obstacles to that interpretation when it doesn't say that. It does have some things that help them, but that those were complied with. It just didn't help them enough. And why think of it that way? And look at the Commerce Clause. Look at a few of these other provisions, which seem pretty clearly to be designed to create a single nation and not a treaty of independent states like a confederation. But just in case that's what he thought, I think it's pretty hard to substantiate. It isn't so now, because we did have that war. And we do have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And we do have 150 years that brings us together. I think he's showing, in other words, that the treaty interpretation of the Constitution won't work. I mean, it didn't work. And it did help bring about that Civil War. And finally, of course, which I haven't said a word about because I'm being a lawyer, and I'm being a lawyer trying to put a matter in the context of history, and I haven't said much of a word about the morality of it, just letting you assume that. And I don't know if you want to read Taney on the morality. I'd read Uncle Tom's Cabin. Good book. If you haven't read it, I recommend it. It's not a tract. It's not a tract at all. It's a good novel that tries to go into the explanation of the incoherence from a moral point of view of slavery. It just doesn't work. It's morally incoherent. But that isn't Dred Scott. Here's the morality of Dred Scott. It's interesting, the obverse of it and the positive part. I was giving a talk, when I first got interested in this, I was talking to a group of students about it, a pretty good-sized group, and we went through some of the issues we're discussing. And I said, okay, let's imagine something. We really don't know what went on in those first meetings of the judges when they were trying to hammer out some kind of unanimous agreement. But let's imagine, just for the fun of it, let's imagine this. Let's imagine you're sitting in your office and Taney comes in and he says, Judge, you're Curtis. He says, Judge, I have a suggestion. I have the votes. I have 7 votes for this opinion. But I won't write it if you can bring yourself not to dissent. Instead, here's what we'll do. We'll write one paragraph. And that paragraph will say, we feel we must affirm the decision of the Missouri court because this is really Missouri law and it's up to them, case dismissed, and nobody even know what that means. Fabulous. Now, if we decide it that way, There is no rule of law saying a man or woman of African descent is not a citizen of the United States. There is no rule of law saying that the Missouri Compromise, the Northwest Ordinance or whatever, and a lot of other things contrary to the Constitution of the United States. There is no law that says that the Due Process Clause protects slavery. Think about that. How much better that would be for you. And by the way, if I'm looking into the future, by doing that, maybe we'll avoid a civil war. Maybe this thing will all take care of itself naturally, and maybe slavery will eventually go away, even without a civil war, and you don't know that it won't. And if you have a civil war, by the way, which you might think was a good thing, who's going to win? It was touch and go. The North might have lost it. And then where would we be? And now all you have to do to avoid all those terrible things is sign. Just sign on the line. Just say you don't dissent. So I put that to the students. I said, what are you going to do? No civil war, which the North might have lost. No due process clause, saying slavery is a violation. Northwest Ordinance, Missouri Compromise, still there. The descendant of an African is still a citizen of the United States. Just don't dissent. Just don't dissent. What do you do? Just put over silence. And then a small voice, absolutely tremendously, coming back says, say no. Everybody applauds. Quite right, isn't it? If you say yes, there's only one problem. You are selling Dred Scott into slavery. Now he will be anyway, but that isn't your doing. And he just, that little voice in the back, was thinking, you just can't do it. You just can't do it. And I like that. I like that. I like that because it describes certain things that occasionally do come up. And you can be all the utilitarian you want, but sometimes something comes up and says, no, I'm sorry, I just can't do it. And that, I think, was the feeling of the audience.
Well, that brings us to the end of the program today. I hope you found it informative and enlightening. Let me know what you think. Drop me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. Keep it right here at PRN.FM. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. See you tomorrow for Free Your Mind Friday. Get your brains in gear. Bye-bye.